Final Four is all set for Saturday night. It's all number one seeds. Florida takes on Auburn, and Houston meets Duke. The NCAA championship game is Monday night. The forecast today from the National Weather Service, partly sunny for the morning, but then sunny, breezy, and seasonal for the afternoon, a high of 46. Right now, wind northwest at 9. It's cloudy, 35 Kenosha, 33 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's always great when we can have an educator on the program. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome teachers of various stripes from various locales. And today I'm especially happy that we can talk to someone who actually has, in a sense, one foot in the Kenosha Unified School District and the other in the Racine Unified School District. His name is Scott Coey, and he is a social studies teacher at Bradford High School, which is part of the Kenosha Unified School District. He has taught there for 9 years. But Scott Coey is also a member of the school board for the Racine Unified School District. And as many of you certainly in Racine are, I'm sure, well aware, tomorrow voters in Racine will be voting on an operational referendum for the Racine Unified School District. And this comes not long after a very substantial referendum for the Kenosha Unified School District failed. And we should also mention that this is one of a total of 10 referendums that are on the ballot tomorrow. 4 in Racine County, 3 in Walworth County, 3 in Kenosha County, of varying sizes, not all of them operational referendums. And we'll talk in a moment about the distinction between what a operational versus a capital referendum is. But we're going to give Scott Coey, as a member of the school board, to talk about the referendum, why it was drawn up by the school board, why he, of course, sees it as an important step forward for the school district if it passes. And then we will spend some time talking about his work as a teacher. And so I think both halves of this conversation are going to be important and interesting. And Scott Coey, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Since this is your first time talking to me on the Morning Show, I think we should right off the bat just learn a little bit about you, where you come from originally, and maybe at least in brief fashion, something about what ultimately drew you into this life as an educator.
So I've always lived in Racine. I've lived here since I was born in 1988, and I've always been I was a Southsider for most of my life, where my parents lived and grew up and raised me here. Then in 2012, moved to the North Side for a little brief period, and then moved back to the South Side when I bought my first house in the Humble Park neighborhood where I was born and pretty much raised. Then, as far as education, I can still remember my first day in 1993 in Miss Fisher's kindergarten class at S.E. Johnson Elementary. Then, going from S.E. Johnson, where I still love that building, to Mitchell Middle School and eventually to Park High School in my last class with Mr. Shishel in sports literature, where I graduated in 2006 from Park. And what ended up causing me to go in education was my favorite teacher by Mr. Mano. Not to say that the other teachers weren't vitally important to that as well, but Mr. Mano was always my favorite teacher. He taught graphic communications, basically a printing class. And what he did was he loved what he was teaching in front of me. And when he retired my junior year, I realized I loved what he was doing, which was teaching. Not to say I didn't love the class, but that I loved what he was actually doing, which was teaching. Then I decided, well, I love history, so that kind of goes hand in hand, and I liked learning about those things. I have a grandfather who's a Vietnam veteran. My dad was a Union guy. I have a great uncle who grew up during Prohibition and would talk about stories when he lived up in Minnesota. So I just always had a fascination with learning from people who had experiences that I can never have and just learning from them. So I decided to be a teacher, and that's how that kind of that path got me to education.
Where did you end up going to college and officially training to be a teacher?
So initially, I went to UW Parkside, and some people know that UW Parkside had a little bit of an issue with this education program at the time. And when I was a sophomore in college, their education program got shut down. So I had a decision: do I stay at UW Parkside, or do I transfer? And I made the decision to stay. I loved my professors, Dr. Bruce, Dr. Gelat, and many of the other ones. That was such a wonderful history program there. And so I decided to stay because of the education I was receiving at Parkside. Shortly after I graduated from Parkside in 2012, I decided, well, I need to go get my teaching license now. So I ended up at Cardinal Stritch, which is sadly closed within the last, I think, year or two. But I went there from, I believe, 2013 to 2014, and did my student teaching at Gilmore Middle School in Racine, and then Harborside Academy in Kenosha. And then eventually I subbed in Racine Unified for a year and a half, and thought I would get hired at my alma mater at Park. Didn't work out, sadly, as much as I love the building, but things have they work themselves out. I ended up getting hired at Bradford High School in the summer of 2016.
Very good. And as I said, a little bit later in the program, we're going to talk about your experience as a teacher at Bradford High School. Let's find out briefly about what prompted you to want to become part of the school board for the Racine Unified School District. Again, you make your home in Racine. You are originally from Racine. But it's quite a leap in terms of taking on or seeking the responsibility of helping to shepherd the Racine Unified School District. When did that happen, and what prompted you to want to do that?
So in 20, I want to say 20, it had to have been around 2014, 15, 16, the state kind of got involved in Racine Unified, and they kind of forced Racine into carve up into districts. And we had a superintendent at the time that I was seeing through social media and other forms of contact that they weren't happy with the then superintendent. I also will throw out my obligatory, I speak for myself and myself alone. I cannot and will not ever speak for the entire school board, so I just need to give that minor disclosure. But I saw how they were feeling, and a few years later, because after they districted, Dennis Weiser had won the district, and he had been a teacher for a long time in Racine Unified. I believe he was a math teacher at Case, and he was the Racine Educators Association president for a while. And then in 2018, 2019, when Lolly Hawes left, we got Eric Gallion, and it just, I for some reason I felt the urge to want to get involved in my district. I saw what was happening with the schools. They had transitioned at the high schools from this like basically a 5 out of 8 model where you teach five classes, you have a duty on one period, and they went to block, and I just saw how frustrated they were. And I was subbing at Park at the time, and I had a teacher by the name of Miss Ludvigson who said, I want you to remember what this is like, this prep, because they're about to take it from us, and they're going to ask us to do more work for nothing. And I had her, and I had a number of other influential teachers, her being one of the few I have left in the district. And then in late 2019, I decided I'm going to give this a go. I'm going to give it a run, ironically, against Dennis Weiser. I had helped collect signatures for the prior time he had ran. And I had been in the district in Kenosha for a few years, but I felt like I could do more for my home. I love Racine. Dr. John Bunker called us Invention City when he talks about Wisconsin history. And I felt like Racine Unified was struggling based on some other issues as it relates to funding and a number of other things. And the general demeanor and attitude of the staff was they were frustrated. So I felt like, well, who better to serve than somebody who's already currently in the classroom? And I filled out the paperwork and ran. I just ironically had to also run during the COVID pandemic, which made that a little bit awkward, but I ended up winning my race by, I think, about 7 or 8 points.
How common is it for school board members to be either current or former teachers?
My understanding is in certain areas, it seems to be pretty common. The current school board president, Kenosha, is Mary Motter. She's a former educator on my own board. We have, I want to say, two other former educators, whether in private or public capacities, and we had another one by the name of Matt Hansard at one point. So in some districts, it seems like it's fairly common. In other districts that are smaller, maybe a little bit less common. But at least in my time, in the community, it feels like there's always at least one, maybe a couple. So it does feel like it does happen. They're not the majority, but they are members of the board.
We're speaking on today's morning show with Scott Coey, who is a social studies teacher at Bradford High School in the Kenosha Unified School District and a member of the school board for the Racine Unified School District. And we're talking to him today with him, in a sense, wearing both of those hats. And right now, at the outset, we want to focus on his position as a member of the school board for the Racine Unified School District. And as he has already said, he is speaking simply on behalf of himself and his own perspective as we turn to the important topic of the operational referendum that Racine voters will be voting on tomorrow. That is the 1st of April. And we want to add that this is one of a number of public school referendums in the WGTD listening area. A total of 10, in fact, are on various ballots tomorrow, April 1st. 4 in Racine County, 3 in Walworth County, 3 in Kenosha County. Scott Coey, remind our listeners about the nature of this referendum and the fact that it is an operational referendum. It might be helpful to remind our listeners about what that distinction means.
So that is the common thing that is currently happening. There are some that are going to Capitol. And what some people have brought up, well, didn't Racine just go to referendum? Now, that was what you've already kind of alluded to, a Capitol referendum. Racine had an aging infrastructure. I mean, we have tons of buildings. Janes Elementary was from like the 1850s. We have other buildings that are all from the 19th century. And we have two comprehensive high schools that are going to be 100 years old. So, and when I was a student, they were not air conditioned. Mitchell Middle School was not air conditioned in several of the areas. So the school board at that time decided that we needed to invest in our aging infrastructure. We also were going to try and build some new schools as a result of old designs that, because of new issues as it results to school safety, we needed to redesign them, such as Schulte, which had a very open concept, which in today's society is not conducive to a safe environment because you have access to the entire building. So a capital referendum is specifically for buildings. People need to make sure that they understand that we cannot use the money. That $600 million referendum that we had passed is solely for buildings. And if people have driven by, you can see Jurstead completely remodeled on the inside. You can go to Starbucks. All right. It has been added a new elementary wing. You drive by Schulte, brand new building, Red Apple going, a brand new building. We are continuing to do that. Drive by Horlake. You can see some of the things that are going on at Horlake, but we have a number of buildings where those things have already completed, things that are currently happening and things that are going to be continuing to happen. So that is solely for infrastructure. Which is something that I ran on when people had asked me, well, you know, are you supporting the referendum? And I said, yes, but buildings don't teach kids. And my concern because of my teaching in Kenosha was we're hemorrhaging teachers and we are struggling to keep up and we can't keep staffing. And what this referendum, an operational referendum, is specifically for staffing purposes. So, for example, as a result of the Kenosha Unified referendum failing, we now have to increase class sizes. They just raised class sizes if I recall, on Tuesday this past week by, I believe, at the high school, about 3.5 kids are class. So I'm going to get another roughly 18 to 25 kids next year. The other thing is it helps us retain other things. So in Racine, one of the things that our new superintendent, Mr. Gajewski, is really, really hammered, and, you know, myself and the other one that, as far as I know, we are hoping that this is a good thing, and it seems to be working out based on our last report card. Educational assistance, especially in the K-3 area, as a result of Act 20, we need to get kids at reading level by third grade, or we need to basically keep up with it. So the operational referendum allows us to keep staffing. So at Racine, my understanding is, based on what we have been presented, is it's going to allow us to keep those educational assistants in those K-3 models. It's going to allow us to retain certain academy classes that are unique to Racine. It's going to allow us to not raise class sizes. Unfortunately, the superintendent had to present, like, this is the ramifications if we don't pass this. Like, elementary, we're talking kindergarten classes in the upper 20s, maybe 30. We're talking fifth grade classes, or late elementary, early middle school classes in the at 30 to potentially low 30s at high school classes in the 40s. And this is not sustainable. That is why we are going to referendum. And I don't know if you want me to go into the formula and the reimbursement and the lack of funding as a result of inflation, but that might be a future question, I'm guessing.
Right. I think we will certainly get to that at some point, because there are certainly some who would suggest that part of what needs to happen in Madison with the way in which the formula for supporting public school districts is calculated and implemented and so on. Let's find out a little bit more about how this specific referendum took shape. And again, let's just reiterate that you are not the official spokesperson of the Racine School Board. You are speaking for yourself, offering your own perspectives. But at least in the most general sense, help us understand the nature of the kind of conversations and also, frankly, calculations that have gone into the crafting of this referendum and the specifics around it.
So, having dealt with the differences between the Kenosha one and the Racine one, this one will cost the taxpayer roughly $35 per $100,000. When we were presented this, as far as I recall, Mr. Gajewski, along with our chief finance officer, Jeff Sarek, and others, knew that we had just had a referendum and we had to make this as manageable for the taxpayer as possible. And so we needed to present where graduation rates are going up, progress is happening, we are getting better school report cards, all these positive things that are happening. And what was presented to us is, if we don't have a referendum right now, we're going to be cutting $24 million. And I don't know where he's supposed to find $24 million. So he came to us and basically said, we need to pass a referendum. Here's my rationale. This is what it will cover exactly. And we need to push this out to the community. And the board had the conversation. And as far as I recall, that vote was either 7-0 or 8-0. I believe a member or two may have been absent. So we, at the time, unanimously agreed that we need to go to referendum so that way we can retain these operational pieces. And as a teacher, again, in Kenosha, where theirs did not pass, we're already dealing with the ramifications of that. I mean, I already know of teachers that are considering leaving Kenosha Unified. And to be clear, those aren't usually your new teachers, although those are ones that are being told right now, hey, you're not staying. For example, one of my psychology teachers at Bradford was just told, sorry, but we don't have a job for you next year as a result of other things. A teacher was pushed out of one building, pushing her out. And some other areas that have seen cuts. So I just know that if that's happening for us in Kenosha, it's going to happen in Racine. And we won't have a choice but to do those things that are not conducive to a good learning environment. But that's why the board, my perspective again, is we had to take action. And we had to concur with the superintendent, Mr. Gajewski, about these things. Even though, again, I know the community has the reservations because of what we just asked for. But again, capital referendum, buildings, operational referendum, staffing.
So this is funding for a completely different purpose. I mean, obviously a related purpose or adjacent purpose, but this addresses a different need, and of course a significant need as far as you and the school board are concerned. Explain the specifics of how this works, I guess maybe the word is mathematically. Over the course of the next 5 years, we are talking about a substantial amount of additional revenue that can flow into the Racine Unified School District. How does that sort of incrementally change year by year?
So the math on this is $35 per 100,000. And to be clear, we're not asking for more. Mr. Gajewski wanted to, this is what we're currently at. We want to retain what we currently have in hopes that the state will figure out its purpose. So when we're talking mathematically, for example, if you have a $300,000 house, you are looking at about a $105 increase. My house, for example, is approximately, its assessment that just came is about $150,000, $160,000 where I'm located. So I'm looking at about a $51 increase. If you're in a $200,000 house, you are looking at a $70 increase. So each year when you get your assessment, that will, as far as I know, will determine what your tax will be as it relates to this five-year non-recurring referendum. So for 5 years, whatever the whatever your assessed value is, $35 per 100,000. So we don't, I don't see this as a very large ask. We're asking to maintain. You know, my uncle wanted an explanation, and when he was like, "Oh, it's only going to be I think for him, his house is just under $400,000, only $120. Okay, that's not as, you know, somebody had said, "Oh, it's $120 per month." He was like, "God, that's ridiculous." And I said, $120 for the year. And we joked and said, so $10 a month, like X cents a day. So it's not, he's like, "You know what? That's manageable. I can work with this."
So the funding that will flow in, we are not talking about, at least mostly, vast expansion of offerings. What this really is about, from the way you've characterized it, is managing to maintain what is in place and managing to sustain the progress that has been made in recent years in terms of student success rates and so on. I mean, is that the best way to characterize this?
Yeah, I give you a personal example. My niece is currently a student at Red Apple, and she was struggling a little bit with some of her letters and whatnot, and they were trying to make sure that she can recognize by sound, amongst other things, certain letters. And she fell a little bit lower. She was struggling a little bit with a few of them, especially like her C's and K's. She couldn't say S's at certain points. She called me Uncle Cotty that she can't get the S out. And so these EAs at Red Apple pulled her and gave her one-on-one assistance. And over the course of, I want to say it was like a month or two, giving her that assistance, she is now proficient, as caught up. She knows all her letter sounds, and they also help at the time just double check with some of her math, all right? Can she count to 20? She's now getting to the point where she can count to 100. So those aides that Mr. Gajewski wants to retain in the district, maintain those aides that are helping our youngest kids. And we know now kindergarten and those early grades are vital to academic success for students.
I did see on the school district's website in the information about this referendum that there is at least a bit of investment in safety and security that is also part of this. Can you just say a word about what we might potentially be talking about there?
We're talking probably security, staff security. You know, this is something. I was in fifth grade when Columbine occurred, and I was a freshman in college when the Virginia Tech shooting took place. And I mean, it's gotten worse. I have been in, God, at Bradford, I've probably been in at least 10 lockdowns. A couple of years ago, we were in a SWATI incident. I don't know if you may recall that incident. And we've had, sadly, other incidents. One that took place at Bradford several years ago. Racine had invested in metal detectors 2 or 3 years ago, and we also, you know, the metal detectors only go so far. We need staffing. We need to continue to operate our security cameras, the software that goes with it. So it's not just a matter of, it's those components. Those things just don't happen. We need to have staff there to ensure those things are taken care of so the students can feel like they are in a safe and secure learning environment. So ensuring we retain that staff for those purposes.
What do you and other school board members generally do in terms of trying to help ensure that this referendum is successful? I mean, are you charged in any very specific or even official way to be out there in the community supporting this, or is that kind of up to each of you in terms of what you do, where you go, what you say, in terms of trying to encourage people to vote yes for this referendum?
To once again just kind of reiterate, I speak for myself and myself alone, but my perception has been that it's up to each board member on how they generally choose to promote or advocate against the referendum if they so choose. I have taken it upon myself to advocate as much as I can, whether that vis-a-vis that social media, whether that's informing my own family members who they don't understand why are you asking for money again, whether it's talking to my own friends, talking to educators who live in Kenosha, but or live in Racine, but they teach in Kenosha, so they may ask me. So I personally advocate for it. I have family. I have nieces. I have a nephew. He's the current ranked number one kid at Case in the sophomore class. I want to ensure that my nieces and my nephew get the best education possible. So I personally advocate. What the other board members choose to do is entirely up to them. There is no obligation on us to technically do anything.
So voters in Racine will have on the ballot this referendum, this operational referendum for the Racine Unified School District. My guest today on the morning show, Scott Coey, is a member of the school board for the Racine Unified School District. He makes his home in Racine. Racine is where he was born and raised, but he is actually a teacher in Bradford High School in the Kenosha Unified School District. Scott Coey, you have a program there at Bradford that sounds really exciting, and we're going to be getting into a few specifics about that in a moment. First, I wonder if you could just talk a moment about what led you into this particular academic discipline. I mean, specifically, being a social studies teacher. What was most attractive to you about that? What made you think this would be the most interesting arena in which to be a teacher?
I guess the best way to put it is my own family and the teachers, and I was fascinated about how we are products of the people that came before us, and we are the society we live in, the decisions that they made. I have a grandfather who was drafted in 1968, and was sent to Vietnam for his 13 months, and mind you, he does not talk about it a ton. He will talk with me about it if I ask. And hearing the things that he has told me, it validates some of the things that people talk about with Vietnam and goes against some of the things. But he also acknowledges his own unique situation as an engineer over in Vietnam. And then his time as a union worker, whether through the American Motors Corporation when it was there in Kenosha, and then as it became Plymouth and Chrysler. I could also talk about my great uncle who, growing up in northern Minnesota, his parents and my understanding his family making moonshine in the back during Prohibition. I could talk about a number of other things, but I was fascinated by the stories that people told me about their past and how it kind of transformed them and their perspectives. My grandfather, 100% true patriot. I couldn't ask for a better man to be my grandfather, and he inspired me to kind of love that topic. Now that topic has blown up into some other things. I teach history, geography, and sociology are the primary three things. A couple of those classes at the AP level, and next year I'll be teaching the Educators Rising program at Bradford. So it was just, I loved what my teachers were doing. I loved history class. I was always fascinated with certain things. In college, I had wonderful professors, Dr. Bruce and Dr. Gelat in particular. Dr. Gelat and Dr. Bruce probably are in my top five all time, but Dr. Gelat is tied with Mr. Mantle as my most inspirational teachers. I love them both for what they did for me, what they continue to do for me. When I got elected, Mr. Mantle actually reached out and told me he was proud of me, and it kind of got me in the feels, and I knew I was trying to do the right things. And Dr. Gelat, I've kept in contact with her since I've graduated, and continue to have conversations about history. Geography is probably my new favorite thing. So many things that people just don't understand that are geopolitical. And I'm sure my understanding is years ago, geography was a normal thing to talk about with the whole Soviet Union, United States, the capitalist communist thing. People were knowledgeable about geography. And I love talking about geopolitics and teaching the things that kids may not understand about certain topics. I'm exceedingly fascinated. I have foreign exchange students. I love hearing their thoughts about what's going on. I have a German foreign exchange student. I keep in contact with a former student from Spain almost 10 years later. So it fascinates me to talk to people with different backgrounds and different things, and just to have that dialogue about history.
Sometimes we hear about young people, and I hesitate to make gross, lazy generalizations here, but I think it's fair to say that there are plenty of young people in the current scene who do not find themselves naturally gravitating to history, and that and I would say, even at the collegiate level where I teach, I think sometimes one has to really put in sort of extra effort to make people interested in what has already happened and the historical road which has led all of us to where we are right now. They're among at least a certain swath of young people, and for that matter even older folks, is I think sometimes a prejudice, a preference for what is closer to our current day and maybe more familiar to us in a sense. And clearly you for a long time have not been part of that, but what would you say are the ways in which you seek to generate in your students the same sort of love of history and fascination with history that you've had for a long, long time?
So I have a deep fascination with Mr. Rogers, and sadly most kids today don't know who he is. And Fred Rogers said, you know, the best teachers love what they're teaching in front of kids. And the kids watch me get excited talking about population growth and pyramids, or I'll make fun of like the Malthusian theory, which is this whole like easy way to say is Thanos in the Marvel universe is an idiot. It's just, he's a guy named Thomas Malthus from the United Kingdom when their population exploded due to the Industrial Revolution. And they see me get excited and they're like, you're a nerd. And I'm like, and I'm okay with that. And I get so excited with, I teach AP World History and I read so much. And that's something I think, I feel like young people, people my age, millennials and whatnot, they're reading more and they're fascinated with those things. And I always bring in, like, I just finished a book by Timothy Snyder, Bloodlands. And it's the, it's Bloodlands, Europe between Hitler and Stalin. And I like, on occasion, I'm like, I bring in the book and I share something that I just read in it. The sheer like hatred and the depth of killing that took place before World War II took under Stalin in a genocide called Holodomor in Ukraine. Like the kids are like, oh, well, that makes sense. Now I get why the Ukrainians hate the Russians in a modern context. And I think when I share these books with kids, whether it's that or right now in sociology, we read this book, Evicted, Poverty in the American City by Matthew Desmond. And the kids are fascinated because it's Milwaukee. It's literally a sociologist who lives with these people who are being evicted. And the kids are like, they see me get excited. And therefore, I think they feed on that. Now, am I going to reach every kid? Absolutely not. But what I can tell you is the vast majority of kids, when they see a teacher excited about a topic, they are more inclined to pay attention than to somebody who's we all had that teacher who just kind of sits there and it's that monologue, dry eye for tear rise guy, where it's one voice, one tone, and it puts you to sleep. But that's just not me. I can't do that. I love what I talk about, what I teach about, and I try to encourage with, here's a book. I have this suggestion, or, oh, here's this. We watched The Truman Show, and I've used that movie since I started 9 years ago, and sociology, and kids that have no idea about that movie with Jim Carrey, and they get done with it, like, well, like they're like baffled, like, oh my God, he was completely manipulated. And I said, yeah, but he had a choice. He still had free will. And the kids just, they're mind blown. So it's just being excited and loving what you teach in front of kids, I think, is how you do it.
I'm curious, for somebody who, for instance, teaches what you do in the Kenosha Unified School District, how much freedom do you have in terms of what you are going to teach, what you are going to cover, and how you are going to teach it?
So with AP, I have zero leeway. AP sets the curriculum. So advanced placement, AP World History, I have to cover 1200 to 1450, which is like Song Dynasty China. You have Europe's going through the plague. You have to talk about Genghis Khan. It kind of sets the standard. Then you jump to land-based and sea-based empires, Industrial Revolution and imperialism, global conflict and Cold War. I don't get a choice. AP Human Geography, same thing. I have to talk about population geography, migration, cultural geography, political geography, agricultural geography, which is weird. The kids actually get into that one when I get excited, living in a, like, weirdly, go west of the interstate, rural community, agricultural, then I have to do urban geography. So I get no say in that. I have to teach these exact things, and that's the expectation. And I've had very successful results in teaching those classes and sticking with the exact curriculum. And the kids, for the most part, like the curriculum that AP has set forth. Sociology, the district, kind of sets the parameters. If I want to step outside of those parameters, I have to speak with kind of like the district social studies guy and, hey, I have these ideas. I also do run it by my directing principal, whether it's the one that I had prior when I started using Evicted in class, or the current one, if I have new ideas. You know, some of the kids throw ideas at me. Like, some of the kids felt like, you know, you talk about the prison system a lot, you know. How come we don't get into, like, domestic abuse? So they'll pitch ideas at me, so I want to get ideas from the kids, but then I need to run it by the district for what may be controversial topics. The district sets, hey, there are things, you need to follow these parameters. So sociology, I get a little bit more leeway. When it comes to the educators rising, I still don't know, but I think those are set kind of by Parkside and Carthage. So some of the classes, I have no leeway. With sociology, I have more freedom. They set a general standard. The state also sets its standards. As long as I'm within the state's skills, the district's expectations, I have a little bit of freedom to cover certain topics.
One of the most exciting things about what you do at Bradford High School is that you have organized and executed what sounds like some really exciting trips. And if I understand correctly, these have at least mostly been trips to other countries. First of all, tell us when this began and under what circumstances this began.
So Bradford and Tremper and other schools around the state or local area, however you choose to put it, have been doing this for a while. And in my situation, my two predecessors, Dean Hervat and Ms. Doherty or whatnot, they were running the trips. Dean Hervat, he's been retired now for 6 or 7 years, and he was running them, and he would run trips. He did a lot of World War II stuff because he was very fascinated with that. And then Ms. Doherty, she had done some in Europe, and then she her last one, I believe, she did was to Australia, and she was having kids, so she couldn't run them anymore. And the last one she was supposed to do was supposed to be to Japan, and then the pandemic happened, so they had to cancel it. And, you know, Education First, the tour company that does this, they had to shift. And how they did it, I still don't remember exactly because I wasn't involved in the trips. So it was passed on to me, like, hey, do you want to run the trips? I was single at the time, no kids, and I was like, you know, this would be a phenomenal opportunity. So I ran the first trip a couple of years ago to Greece and Italy, and we packed that bus. We there were no spots left. We had, with chaperones, 51 travelers to Greece and Italy. It was wonderful. It was magnificent. The kids, the sheer excitement that they had when we got, it was 117 when we arrived in Athens, and those kids did not care one bit. They were ecstatic too, like, oh my God, I'm literally in Athens, Greece. When we could drive by and you can see the Parthenon, the excitement on kids' faces. And, you know, we had this wonderful trip there and in Athens, in Meteora. If anybody ever goes to Greece, you got to go to Meteora, all right? It's this beautiful city. It has a reason for its geographic situation, the geology, the plateaus there. Then we went to Florence and Rome. Florence is a beautiful city. For those that have been there, they know exactly what I'm talking about with the Duomo. And then I can't speak enough, like, the sheer aura of walking up and seeing the Colosseum. The kids, like, I had this one kid who, like, he would always, like, touch the ground. He's like, I can't believe I'm physically here. And you know, I could talk more about it. We had I can't speak highly enough of EF. We had a student who sadly passed away from a brain aneurysm, and EF made sure that that kid, the parents, they got every dollar back. They worked with them as quickly as possible. And even when we arrived, the tour director had known about it, and he bought a wreath so that we could lay it in the Aegean for that young lady. And it was just a phenomenal trip. And then last summer, we did South Africa. I like... just I can't, like, people should go to Africa at some point in their life. And I went to we went to Johannesburg, Kruger National Park, and Cape Town in South Africa. And the tour director, Frank, talked so much about apartheid. He was a young man when apartheid was going on in the 70s with the Afrikaners language being forced, I think is how he presented it. And he talked about how he himself was shot when he said he was 11 or 12. And the kids were, like, so drawn into what Frank was teaching them, the museums, the history behind Nelson Mandela. Going and seeing animals out in nature in Northeast South Africa at Kruger National Park, Cape Town, Table Mountain, like the kids, the things they saw, whether they were in Greece and Italy, the kids, when they saw the poorest of the poor in South Africa, I had a kid and he walked up to me and said, "I'll never take anything I have for granted ever again." Seeing what these kids have and how happy they are despite having no running water, no guarantee of a meal. But the kids, it's such an eye-opening experience to see these things. And this next summer, we're going to go to Japan and South Korea, going from where humanity started, the cradle of humanity where we visited, and Greece and Athens, to two of the most technologically advanced countries on the planet. So the kids were, I think we're taking 26 kids this summer to Japan and South Korea, and I'm excited. Hmm.
Who is eligible to be part of these trips, and are these geared for particular courses that you teach, or is essentially anybody who is a student at Bradford and interested and has the means to do this? Is this an opportunity open to essentially anyone?
It is open generally to the Bradford students. I work with a teacher over at Bullen Middle School. To try and offer it up to the middle school students in advance. I also open it up to students, if they're going to Bullen, but they're going to end up at Indian Trail, that's not their fault. And Indian Trail, I think, has a program, but they may not do the same trip. So I don't discourage kids from going, or Lakeview and Reuther, Harborside. Those kids at those schools are more than welcome to come. And I've had students from those schools that come with. And the idea is, the first time I did it about a two-year planning cycle. And the idea is plan it out as far as possible, because every student is welcome to come, all right, if they have the means to do it, if they can plan ahead. And I've had students, the student who passed away, her family made sacrifices with the hope that she would be able to go, and then, freak situation, sadly, she passes. But they were making it work. And I've had other students that they work 2 years to pay for their own trip. They save every dollar, every penny to get themselves to those locations. And with the, I had always done the two-year cycle. So it was just, hey, I plan this out. We make the announcements. People show up. Hey, if you can make this work, here's the price. Here's your payment per month. And that's what happens. This will be my last one because I'm getting married, and there's no guarantee when the kids will happen. But I pass it off to another teacher. So I told her, I said, you know what? I feel bad because Bradford serves a population where we do have a lot of low-income students. And I said, EF allows you to plan 3 years in advance. Why don't you do the 3-year in advance model? And she's already got more kids signed up for her trip to Europe than I did for Japan after multiple signups. So, trying to encourage, the idea is, we want as many kids to go and have this experience. And I've had affluent kids, I've had poor kids, I've had middle-class family kids, I've had parents come with or whatnot. The idea is make it as affordable as possible so that way any kid can have the opportunity to do this.
What determines where you're going to go? Obviously you're not going to the very same places over and over again. Does it sometimes have to do with sort of what's going on in the world, or what might be a particularly interesting place to go? Or are you just in general just kind of mixing it up and making sure that there is an interesting and intriguing mix of opportunities?
So my idea is always to kind of mix it up. So the first one, we have the north side of Kenosha. Anybody who's from Kenosha knows north side Kenosha. That's heavy Italian community. It's been that way for over 100 years. And I was like, you know what? That was one of the trips that they had planned. And that one was just outright canceled, if I recall correctly. And the Italian club at Bradford had saved up this money to try and go on that trip. And so I figured, you know what, it's Italy and Greece, and that it's just, it's going to sell. It's Italy and Greece. And even when we got there, our tour director said Greece is the number one location along with Italy for all their trips. They have more tour directors than they can count. EF does in Greece and Italy. So when that was decided, you know, I had an abundance of kids. I figured that one made sense. But afterwards, I decided, why not give the students a kind of a say in these things? And so I usually narrow it down to like two or three. Getting somebody, it's like trying to get somebody to pick lunch. Don't give them free rein. Narrow it down to a couple. So I had narrowed it down to, I think, with South Africa, I think I had thrown out Thailand, South Africa, and I think Peru. And South Africa won. Now, mind you, that was a much smaller group, but that was what the students had decided. And I said, guys, I know the cost is going to be higher. And we were originally expecting, I think, 16 or 17, but inflation, a number of other things were going on in personal people's lives. I ended up only taking, I think, 8 people on that trip compared to the 51 for the other one. The Japan and South Korea, I stuck with Japan and South Korea and Peru. The other thing that I decided is we're not just going to keep going to Europe. As much as Europe sells, kids should be able to give it an opportunity to let's go to different continents, see different things. And that was the person I passed it off to. I said, promise me that you will not just do Europe nonstop. And so she's decided to do that. The one after Europe, where they're going to go to Amsterdam. I think they go to Frankfurt, Munich. They're going to go to Venice in Italy. They go to, I know they're going to Switzerland. They're going to Eastern France, Paris, and London. And that one's, like, again, that one was really, really popular. Again, where they got, I think, a little over 30 kids. And then the following year, they're going to go to Peru. So it's, the idea is to give options to the kids. And that way they can plan these things out well in advance. So with the Europe one being now a little over 2 years away, and the other one almost 3 years away. So we kind of, it's a mix. We decide as the group leaders, and the students get a little bit of a say in what do we want to do.
Right. I like that idea a lot, and it just sounds like an incredibly exciting and meaningful experience. And, of course, it's an experience for a relatively limited number of students, but I should think just the ramifications of all that they learn and are excited about, which they, in turn, share with schoolmates and friends and neighbors and so on. I mean, this is something that is probably important even beyond those students that are blessed to be able to go. Well, before we go, we want to remind everyone, of course, about the referendum, the operational referendum that confronts voters in Racine tomorrow, April 1st. It is one of 10 different referendums, and we didn't get a chance today to talk about some of the issues in Madison involving how funding for public school districts is calculated, and that is an ongoing conversation about how those calculations can be fairer and sufficient for the various needs of various school districts. That conversation will have to occur on another day. But in the meantime, I'm so glad that we could have this conversation today. Scott Goey, a social studies teacher at Bradford High School in Kenosha and a member of the school board for the Racine Unified School District. Thank you so much for your time and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. I hope you have a wonderful day as well.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, David Anderson, the music director of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, talks about their next concert, which is coming up this Saturday. And an amazingly feel-good story from recent American history with the author of a book called The Candy Bombers, which tells the inspiring story of the airlift to the citizens of Berlin immediately after the Second World War. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show here on WGTD. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, wgtd.org. Skies will be coming eventually sunny today. It will be breezy and a high of 46 degrees. Our overnight low tonight, 28. Tomorrow, partly sunny and a high of 43, warming to 66 on Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine, Elk.